Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering 2 shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks so much for listening. Big show today. 2 guests, 2 great guests, Mike Tirico, NBC Sports, and Steve Kornacki from MSNBC and NBC News, who's now looks like going to become sort of a regular here on the Sunday night pregame show with Tirico. They're on the pod today, separate interviews, get into a lot of the election stuff with Kornacki. If you're a Trump supporter, just shut the podcast off right now and don't send me any tweets or emails because I don't care. Tirico was tremendous just going through his career and all his roles at NBC. Was pretty honest about, you know, he left ESPN to call Thursday Night Football and then the NFL. Told NBC they had to use Al and Chris, their number one team on the game. So we got into that with Tirico and talked about him leaving ESPN and, you know, supposedly being the, you know, guy who's going to take over for Al Michaels when he leaves. So, Tirico was great with all of that. Now, obviously, Kornacki, we talked about him doing Sunday Night Football and what election night was like for him. So great pod with those two. Let me just quickly tell you, previous episodes of the SI Media Podcast that featured Chris Long, Andrew Marchand, The Undertaker, Jim Nantz, all those in the archives. So if you're not a subscriber, please subscribe to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. It helps tremendously. And we will now get to today's show. Mike Tirico first. Steve Kornacki, second. Here we go. All right, joining me now, very excited for my next guest, doing it all over at NBC Sports, Mike Tirico. Mike, how's it going?
Jimmy, I'm doing great. Good to catch up. How you doing?
I am doing well. Thanks for awesome. Doing this. And,
of course. Fellow New Yorker, this. I can't say no, right?
I would hope not. Well, you grew up in Queens? Is that where you grew up?
I grew up in Whitestone. I grew up, Whitestone. You know, 5-6 minutes from Shea and when it was Shea, and early enough that that was the formative stuff for me, Jets and Mets, and grew up through the rough, and I mean rough, 70s with the Mets and the Jets. Yeah. So I was a hardened fan early on. So, but when the Mets won the series, I was in college at Syracuse, and I was like, okay, I've invested, I've gotten the dividend, I'm moving on. I'm good. But it was nice to have all the bad baseball of the 70s pay off in the championship in 86.
I think you're being very kind by saying rough 70s for the Jets. Oh. I think it's been rough 70s, 80s, 90s, 00s, and whatever, the 10s and the 20s. I think it's all been rough for the Jets.
We live in Michigan and have for a couple of decades now, and I kind of laugh with my son because he's, you know, he kind of root for the team you grow up around. He's grown up a Lions fan. I'm like, hey, I understand. I really understand what it's like.
Yeah. It's funny. I'll pull back the curtain here a little bit, just to give the listeners a little inside story here. When you did the Packers Bears games two weeks ago,
right.
It was a blowout. You had said something about, well, if the Bears have the ball here, if they could score, they get the ball to start the second half. And I tweeted like, good try trying to keep the audience. And you sent me a message saying, well, they did score on that drive.
They did. Where were you? And you didn't get me back.
I'm just curious. So when you're doing games like that, where the first half is just a complete annihilation, how demoralizing is that for you? Because despite what people think about announcers rooting for teams, all you want is a close game. And then that happens.
My number one desire in a broadcast in terms of the result of the game, because really you do become agnostic here with so many teams and, you know, people who you like, people who you get along with, whether it's GMs, team presidents, head coaches, players, all that, they move around, right? What you really want every game, every sport, except for baseball, is the ball is in the air, the clock says zero, and where it comes down is going to determine who won or lost. Then the viewers weren't cheated. You weren't cheated. It was a fun game. Even if it was a bad game, a great ending, a lot of times is a great deodorant for a bad game, right? So, like, you know, you're in the booth for a game like that, and you're absolutely right. You're going, oh, man, this is a bummer. Because you don't want to get into all the stuff you've prepared. You prepared a ton of stuff. We had a bunch of stuff for Notre Dame Clemson and got to about 15% of it because the game never lulled, and it was great. And that's the ideal. That's what you want to do. So you kind of look at those things. I always look at who's getting the ball start the second half. I've joked on football night the last couple of years, especially in our screening room, like teams going for the full Belichick, score the touchdown right to the end of the half, get the ball back. Your offense sits on ice for a half hour and you look up and you're 14 points worse than you were when the offense last went off the field. So I'm always thinking about that with teams. Yeah. And that was Chicago's only avenue back into the game for them. So you're just kind of thinking about that. But I'm sure you echoed what a lot of Bears fans felt.
I did it in jest, but it is, you know, I always watch these games. You know, you did it in a way I thought was fine, but you know what I always watch was like, I don't want announcers to insult the audience and act like, you know, right. I mean, there's still a lot of that that goes on. You know, I was watching a game. Should I call it out? What game was it? I know what it was. What was the? It was a CBS college game. It wasn't the game they had in the afternoon. It was Tennessee, Florida.
Right.
And they did the keys of the game, win the turnover battle. You're insulting your audience at this point. Like, you know, give us something else here.
Right. Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what's funny from that Bears game. The game was over and Tony Dungy did the game with me. You know, our Notre Dame group was on that post Thanksgiving Sunday night game like we were planned to be. And Tony said, "No, well, if you're the Bears, you want to come out here. You want to get a score. It's a fourth quarter. They're losing by 30. Right. You get a score and come back out." And I honestly did say on the air, really, is that going to help you at all for next week? And it was really interesting to hear a coach's perspective of, yeah, it can lay a little bit of a foundation. And you know what? For the Bears, it did. They came out great guns the first three quarters. And just a reminder for us, sometimes we get a little bit sharp, a little bit edgy, a little bit in complaining mode about games or things like that. But coaches do see it in a different way. They're always trying to build for tomorrow.
Right.
And it did for the Bears, and then they became the Lions of 2020 with what happened in the fourth quarter, blowing a double digit lead. Strange stuff.
Yeah, it was the Bam LSU game Saturday. LSU was up 52-14, and Alabama was up 52-14, and LSU kicked a field goal in the second half. To me, I'm like, well, what are we doing here? But coaches
We did Syracuse Notre Dame at Yankee Stadium 2 years ago, and Syracuse's quarterback, Eric Dungy, got hurt. Notre Dame's blowing him out, and we thought it was going to be a really good game. And Yankee Stadium, being a New York kid, a Syracuse alum, doing the Notre Dame games, it was like it was Christmas in November, right?
Yeah.
And then Syracuse is getting shut out. They kicked a field goal in the fourth quarter. I'm like, oh, come on, right? Guys.
Well,
just take the bagel and move on, man. It is what it is, right?
So it's funny, because I was going to ask you, and we'll get into, because you've been busy during quarantine, and you've got some games coming up. But it was funny, because I thought of off that Bears-Packers game that you called with Tony a couple of weeks ago on Sunday Night Football. I wanted to know, you've been doing this a long time, best game you've ever called, worst game you've ever called?
Worst game I ever called was the 3-0 Steelers-Dolphins Monday night in the mud in Pittsburgh, where the punt stuck right at like the 48 yard line.
I don't remember that game.
You don't remember the? Oh, it was a brutal, brutal Monday night game. Yeah. We were looking at a scoreless game. It was a terrible game. They had played the high school playoff games as they often do at Heinz Field. The grass field was really bad. It was a monsoon of rain, and like emblematic of the game, Kornheiser and Jaws were in the booth with me, and Pittsburgh punted. I think it was Pittsburgh punted, and the ball just stuck like right nose up in the field, and it was emblematic of the night, the field, the quality of the game. That was the worst game I did.
So the final was 3-0.
Yeah, and Pittsburgh, Miami, a Monday nighter.
What quarter was? Do you remember what quarter the field goal?
Late. It's fourth quarter. Yeah, it's fourth quarter. Okay. It's towards the end of the game.
So you had some excitement then, at least.
It was the excitement was really, was anybody going to score? It was that bad. The best one. I don't want to get too jaded by the moment, but that Notre Dame Clemson game, double overtime in South Bend, number one, 47-40, no lull in the game. Like I said, that's up there. I'll tell you like an odd one. And it's not always like the biggest matchup games necessarily. We had a Buffalo Dallas Monday night game in Buffalo where Romo threw a bunch of picks.
I remember that game, I think.
And Nick Folk, then a rookie kicker for the Cowboys, hit a field goal, but a timeout was called before the kick. And that was before that was vogue. It had just happened earlier that year for the first time on an NFL stage where, you know, they slam the timeout to freeze the kicker right as he's about to snap it. And then Folk again hits from 52 yards in Orchard Park. And Chip Dean, who directed Monday Night Football and my run there, Jay Rothman produced, Chip Dean directed. Chip cut to Jerry Jones, like an all-time great Jerry Jones. Yeah! Clinch fist shot. It was just a really cool game because the night in Orchard Park was this din. So you mentioned quarantine. They showed that game back. ESPN aired a bunch of Monday Night classics, and there were like three or four great games in a row that I was lucky enough to be a part of.
Yeah.
Like the Saints Monday night return after Katrina, which is my best moment that I've been involved with, but for a game, it's the other one.
Yeah.
And I watched that game, and I've since gotten to know Tony Romo a little bit, and well, you know, maybe a couple of times a year text back and forth. And I texted to Tony. I said, I don't know if you're watching this game, but I'm going to apologize in advance for anything bad I said about you. He was terrible that game.
Yeah. And I'm sure Tony had a funny response back to you. Because
he did. He got back to me with a good laugh and a smile. I was like, I'll get back to you. I'll let you know after I watch. So it was funny.
How weird was it calling a game on a Wednesday last week?
It was odd. It screwed up the whole week. So I got to Pittsburgh. So Detroit's where I live in that area, 4.5-hour drive. So when possible, I've been driving, you know, just to kind of stay safe, stay out of the system. Although, you know, airports have been low numbers. Delta has done as great a job as possible in making it safe to travel around. So I drove to Pittsburgh Tuesday. We went to Steelers practice. We were on our Zoom production meeting with Lamar Jackson, and we're asking him questions. And Fred Gadelli, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football, says, "Hey guys, I don't want to interrupt you, but the game's postponed." Like, that's a good reason to interrupt this, right?
Yeah.
So I called home and I just asked my wife, like, how big a turkey did you buy? She's like, what are you talking about? Like, well, I'm coming home for Thanksgiving dinner. So I went back home for Thanksgiving dinner, did Green Bay Friday, Saturday, Sunday, went from Green Bay to Pittsburgh after the game, did the game in Pittsburgh on Wednesday, then drove home and then drove to South Bend Saturday morning to do the Notre Dame game. So like that 10-day stretch, I didn't know what day it was. I didn't know which city it was.
Right, it all started with you in Pittsburgh already for a game that ends up getting canceled.
Ann Arbor, Pittsburgh, Ann Arbor, Green Bay, Pittsburgh, Ann Arbor, South Bend. And like in between, like, you know, what would it be? It would be 290 players in the 6 days of, which number 12 is this?
Right.
So it was Thanksgiving and the holiday and all that. And, you know, in the middle of that, got an unexpected Thanksgiving with the family. Got to watch both of the games and the dog show and the whole deal. So it worked out fine. It was weird. I will say there's two things. Wednesday was weird because it was Wednesday at 3:30. And at some point you're going, you know, where's like Ellen should be on right now. Like, can you bring me and Collinsworth these nice big comfy chair and we'll tuck our leg under the other one and we'll sit and we'll talk to Matthew McConaughey or something. You know, it felt odd, but, I think the oddest part of all of it has been when you just let your vision get off the field or off the monitor and you pull back and the stadiums are empty or there are friends and family. So it's like 150 people. It's just odd. It really is.
I, I had another play-by-play guy on the I don't remember if it was Nance or Harlan, but one of them in the last 6 weeks to 8 weeks who've been on said the same exact thing. Because I always ask guys who come on, what is it like calling games in the empty stadiums? And they said exactly what you said. You don't really know it when you're calling the play, and then when the camera pans to those stands, it hits you.
Yeah, because I never really did a deep analysis of where my eyes are during a broadcast, right? But you know, you're either binoculars checking something, field looking at a formation, the program monitor where what you're seeing at home for people who don't recognize the TV jargon, or you're looking over to your analyst, right? Or your stats person, somebody in the booth. You're never really taking it all in and stepping back and going, "Hey, here's what the whole building looks like," right? But now you kind of notice when you do get that in your peripheral, go, this is crazy. This is Lambeau Field. And for me, it was three in a row, Jimmy. It was Lambeau, then Pittsburgh, then Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. Like three all-time great venues, passionate fans, senior day in South Bend.
Right.
You would have been talking about 210,000 people in those three venues. And Notre Dame had staff and faculty. So maybe total in the three venues, there were 5,000 or 6,000 people. And it's just really odd. And that we have not gotten, I have not gotten used to that difference in what this year is like for football.
Yeah. It's, you know, you watch on TV and you don't really notice it, but I guess, you know, for you guys who are there, it's TV's done a good job with it. I mean, your game, that game, I don't know if you were aware in the beginning for the first 5-10 minutes, the audio was like way off in that game. And someone had said about, you know, just maybe the prep time you guys didn't have the audio people there. I don't know what it was, but outside of a couple of games, I mean, Fox has had a few games where the noise is just way too loud. But outside of that, you're home watching football on TV. You really don't, it's like the same as it always is. So they've done a good job from that standpoint.
I think two things. One, this has been the greatest victory lap, if you will, or reason for praise to the engineers, the technicians, the producers, the directors, the people who make TV sports, who are the rock stars of this industry anyway. But to deal with COVID protocols and all the stuff that's naturally not there, and to make it a really enjoyable product on TV is a credit to so many different people. And, you know, you talked about the TV experience. On Sundays, when we're in the studio in Connecticut to do Football Night in America, we watch the games in a screening room, and our room setup has changed because we're socially distant now in the room and all that stuff. But you're watching 8 games at once, and then the 4 late games, and you're getting ready for the show, and you don't notice it. And it dawned on me a couple of weeks ago, you don't notice it because they've done such a good job with the Fox games and the CBS games, and obviously Fred on the Sunday night games with NBC, and then ESPN the Monday night games. They've done such a good job of making the product feel as comfortable as possible.
Yeah, they really have. And I mentioned you have, I mean, even through the pandemic, you've called golf, you've called horse racing, Notre Dame, NFL. When I looked at the list of what you've done, I was wondering if there's been another broadcaster who's done as much over the last, you know, 6 months as you, because it's and Football Night in America, I should mention that as well.
Yeah.
You know, were there any reservations about getting back on the road and doing stuff?
Yeah. No doubt. You know, every week there are reservations about traveling because, as we discussed before we started recording here, you don't know. You can take every precaution and it's still not enough. You know, so you're trying to be as careful as possible and, you know, limit socializing back home with your friends and you know, family of kids who are off in college and they come back home. So you're just trying to be as careful to be as available as possible. But I'm very thankful. I've said this a few times. Everything we do is twice as difficult as it used to be. And it's half as fun because you miss dinner with Dungy, with Collinsworth, with everybody on the road. And as I'm sure people have said on your pod, I think I've heard somebody say it on yours, Jim may have said it. A lot of what happens at that Friday night or Saturday night dinner becomes the good stuff on Sunday evening. And you know, we may spark a story about something that becomes a tale we tell on the, "Hey, did you hear Mike Tomlin said? Remember when Tomlin told us that in a production meeting? I thought that was awesome. Reminds me of this." Oh, okay. And then boom, it gets on the air and becomes part of a comfortable conversation. Mm-hmm. So it's all that. I'm thankful. I'm really thankful. One, appreciative of the job more than ever. And, thankful I've had the opportunity to stay really busy and not get into a rut where there was nothing going on. I mean, even in the height of the shutdown, we did a talk show from my home office. We right. did MSNBC, listen to me, NBCSN, noon to one every day for 10 weeks, pretty much. And we had, you know, our NBC family and other guests and a bunch of NASCAR guys. And it was a blast. It was a lot of fun to get back to doing a talk show like in the old radio days. So it has been as busy. There's been no stop really of work. And I'm really thankful for that.
Yeah, I never realized that. I was doing a little research when I knew you were going to come on. I didn't realize you had done the ESPN radio show with Van Pelt at one point, I guess.
So right after Dan Patrick left to go out on his own,
right,
I took over that time slot. It was right when Monday Night Football got started. So I was doing like the show on the road for 2 or 3 hours on a Monday night, and then doing the game, and then going back home and doing the show the rest of the week from you know, set up at home like you have, like so many people have now. I did that for a couple of years. Michelle Tafoya actually co-hosted some shows with me, and Scott did as well. And then Scott became the, and Herbie did some shows with me, Herb Street. And then right. Scott became the permanent co-host, and it worked out great to pass it off. And I keep telling Scott all the time that I helped start his career, but it's said lovingly and jokingly, yeah. He is one of my all-time favorite people and friends. And I love listening to him. I love watching him. We talk, you know, it's like we don't talk for a couple of months and then we'll talk for an hour on the phone and
yeah.
We'll go through a long text exchange every once in a while. He's a great, great dude. But you know what? Like for me, Jimmy, I've come to learn that you really have studied a team. Like, I had the Steelers that Ravens Wednesday afternoon game, and I'll get them on Sunday against Buffalo.
Right.
Like, I know the Steelers pretty well now. I know their backup linebackers, you know, contract status, you know, all that. And what I realized, I'm more suited to that than I am having a hot take on the Red Sox bullpen.
Right.
You know, I just feel like I've a lot of praise for the people who do regular talk shows who have those hot takes, especially nationally. Mm-hmm. I just felt naked out there having a hot take on, well, you know, what's the deal with the Astros and their rotation for 2021? I have no idea, you know, but right. when I'm in deep, I can start telling you that look, the Steelers, Bud Dupree's contract is up. When he gets hurt, he's out for the season. I know his contract's up, and I know Highsmith they drafted, which kind of continues the Steeler tradition of that. And that's just more my style of sports. And
yeah.
I wasn't really cut out for it. I'm glad I had the opportunity to do it and to learn that. And I have great admiration for the people who can hot take it every day, every hour.
I think, and that, just, you know, I'm with you on that. Cause I was going to ask you if you love doing radio. Cause I think I think you have to have a special mindset and be a special personality to do sports talk radio every single day, like you just said. And, you know, I have friends who do it locally. I know mm-hmm. people do it nationally, and like, you know, both, I have one of my best friends here in New York does shows on FAN, and you know, pre-COVID I would say like, oh, let's go out, let's get dinner, let's do it. And I got to pay attention to the Ranger game because I'm on tonight. And it's like, oh Jesus, I would rather, you know, run in front of a moving bus. But you know that, you know,
but that's it. Like FAN, you know, I growing up in New York in the Mike and Mad Dog era and all that, which I loved, you know, when the NFL schedule would come out, win, loss, yeah. loss, win.
Why play the games?
Yeah, right. 9-7. Next, yeah. You know, but they were magical, both of them as yeah. individuals. I'm lucky to get to know both of them here a bit along the way, and they're so super talented and so interesting as a duo and individually and all that.
And Russo still does that because I heard him last week, like, oh my breaking God. Down the NFL playoff picture. And he's like, well, the Vikings are only going to win one more game. Well, how do you know that? But it's just, you know,
he is one of a kind. I've gotten to get to know Chris, our agent. We have the same agent, so I've gotten to know him a little bit. He did. I was on vacation a couple of summers ago, and Russo spent 45 minutes of his own show talking about the travails of his golf trip to the United Kingdom with some buddies, right?
Yeah.
Like, I found myself sitting in the car.
Riveted
because Chris was like butchering the name of famous holes on the road of the British Open, and you know, talking about cities and towns, and it was just invented Chris yelling, screaming. It's just like he's just got a one of a kind personality, and I love it. You know, I think, Jimmy, there's some magic to when you can come off of a Mets game and do an overnight shift for 5 hours and really get in deep. Yeah. That's why I love the fact I'm blessed that I grew up in New York, because the pitching change with the middle reliever in the eighth inning can become the basis for an entire show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And there are very, very few cities that are that granular. It's getting that way with football in a lot of the NFL and college cities, but yeah, baseball not as much. But New York is still, hey, we're, you know, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the pitch selection, you know, to the big hitter. And that's that, that is a, it's a supreme talent. Sports radio is great. And to your larger question, the sports radio that I love is the sports radio that it's not really out there, but it's become podcasts. Mm-hmm. Like, you go back, do you remember the Costas radio show on Sunday nights?
Yes, I do. I do.
That wasn't out there. It was an hour with a guest. Yeah. And it was, you know, Bob, who's as good as it ever gets, just kind of going in deep with someone, a really good conversation. I love that. I miss the long form. Even Roy Firestone's Up Close show on ESPN that Chris Myers did for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, we've got so much out there that was missing. But now the podcast world has brought that back. And I'm really glad to see that, because that's the kind of content I love to absorb.
Yeah. I should you gave me an avenue here to plug. Chris Russo is going to be on the podcast next week. And if you've never heard, I'll give you a little, if you need something to do when you're on the road traveling, go on YouTube and look up when he talked about, I forgot the name. Remember, there were two or three summers ago, there was a gorilla who they shot because the gorilla, the kid got in the thing. He did 20 minutes on that. Yeah. That is like the greatest radio I've ever heard in my life. So if you've never heard that, look that up.
You left Adam and with him all at the same time. He's doing the same thing. And like, you know, but like Chris's his love for the detail of it, which is, I think, what is the question for all of us when we do this. You know, Chris still loves diving deep into today's baseball. And, you know, go back to Mazeroski 1960 and that at bat, you know, a Pirates Yankees game 7. It's a unique talent. I think very few people have it, because they carry the passion day in, day out for decades. And that's hard to do.
Speaking of the passion, you mentioned earlier, I mentioned earlier about you calling so many events through the pandemic with the golf, the horse racing, Notre Dame, NFL, football. If NBC came to you and said, Mike, you're only calling one thing from now on, what do you pick?
I'd say, can I have two?
Nope, you can only pick one.
I love the variety. You know, there's nothing like football. That's, you know, I probably would say that the Notre Dame package has been such a great salvation for me, because when it came to NBC, we had Thursday night, and you know, I left Monday night after 10 years at ESPN and loved it and love calling football. And I think that's what my skill set is best set for. You know, how do you not love the Olympics? Right. But I've only been able to be the primetime host for one Olympics and then do the summer, the 2 hours of the daytime with Al. And there, by the way, there's nothing better than, you talk about the greatest hang of all time, hanging on Copacabana Beach with Al Michaels, hosting the Summer Olympics. It was Rebecca Lowe had the early part of the day, that I had the middle, and Al had the late afternoon. It just, we would joke, because we'd be out there, like, Rebecca's out there, it's windy, her hair's blowing all over the place, I get out there, it's the middle of the day, I'm sweating at time. It's like, once we got to like Al time, like at 4 o'clock, the weather got perfect. And Al just kind of strolled out. We'd have a good laugh. We'd talk about everything under the sun and sport. Nobody liked him. But that probably is the salvation for me of that Notre Dame package. And I've come to love it.
I was going to ask, when you left ESPN, I know the plan was for you to call Thursday night, and then the NFL said they wanted the A team on the game. So when you left ESPN, though, you were not supposed to call Notre Dame, correct?
That was not part of the plan. No,
that's a hell of a gig to end up with, you know, as sort of a backup plan.
And look at how great they've been. They haven't lost a home game in 3 years. We've had, you know, we had one really below average game. Every other game is, but they've played well. The opponents always come in and play them a tough game. I had, you know, because I've been at ESPN, I had never done a game in South Bend, and now, you know, now I've done, I don't know, 20 or 24, whatever the number is over the 4+ years. Mm-hmm. So that having that there was really a perfect mix, and then getting involved in Thanksgiving and other stuff. So, you know, it's weird to say, I think probably in a couple of years that answer would change to the Olympics.
Right.
You know, and what we have coming up, if you ask me what you're excited about, football all the time, of course, but what I'm really excited about when we get to 2021, one is that hopefully we have more of our normal life, whatever that's going to look like back.
Yeah.
We've got a little bit healthier society. And I really hope that we have that stretch of the Summer Olympics in July of 2021, followed by the Beijing Games in 2022 with an NBC Super Bowl in there in early February as well. We've got a stretch of like 200 days that'll be as good as anybody's ever been a part of. And I think going through a cycle like that of hosting two Olympics so close to each other, I think maybe my answer might be different at that point. But you asked me right now, you know, football, doing football games just still gets me going. And I still love the challenge of 90 guys, 10 coaches and GMs and all that. And two or three out of the 100 are going to be the story of the night. And are you going to get it right? I love the preparation for that and the execution.
And obviously, as a broadcaster, no matter what you're calling, what the situation is, you're there giving your A-plus effort and, you know, you do what you always do. But when you, is it in the back of your head when you do an NFL game, you know, okay, 20 million or what, you know, you could do a big golf event on a Sunday, a horse race, you know, it's going to get whatever, 3-4 million, 5. You do the NFL, you know, you're locked in 20 million. Does that like raise it up for you a little bit?
Nope. Never has. I've always been fond of saying the worse the game, the better we have to be, because the worse the game, people are leaving, you know, and you're trying, it's a business. You're trying to keep audience.
It's not even about bad game. It's just about, you know, cause like you said, the NFL is just on another level in this country, you know?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. No. I think having done, you know, so many years of it, there's still that big time feel. In many ways, NFL games are easier to do because in that screening room for Football Night in America, you see every Sunday, every single game. You know, you're watching most of the plays. I've got NFL Network on during the week. You know, after like the first hour of the Today Show, I'm over with Good Morning Football for a couple hours. So you just feel like you're so prepared to do those games that I'm not thinking, oh my gosh, like, you know, if this game's good in the fourth quarter, we're going to have 21 million. No, it's just execute the game. And I think you can do it with more confidence in the NFL than you can the other sports because you do live 24/7, 365, just by following sports. It's like, okay, great. This happened in the NBA. This happened in Major League Baseball. But wait a minute. This happened in the NFL, and that's going to trump everything else for that
right,
day.
Right, I know you have Buffalo-Pittsburgh Sunday. You're doing the game with Chris this coming Sunday, which is a very, very good game. Are you have any more games left in the 2020?
Supposed to have one more, but then again, you never know with, you know, one with flex, with COVID, with everything else. So I think there'll be one more, and then obviously you get down to the playoffs, and we have two playoff games back to back. So hopefully get to do one of those with Tony. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, you mentioned flex. I should ask you because I tweeted this the other day, and NBC has San Fran Dallas next Sunday, the week after Buffalo Pittsburgh, and I was looking at them maybe flexing it out. I think the Saints play KC that day. I had people tell me CBS probably protected that game. And then then people are saying that NBC has said that they will never flex out of a Cowboys game. I find that hard to, I mean, if you have a, I understand the Dallas rating is always going to be there, but you think NBC would never flex out of a Cowboys game?
Yeah. I think we've learned this year to never say never with anything, right? You know, I mean, I think it's been harder too, because NFL teams tend to go south quicker than they used to, you know, and you can always count. Now, you know, Dallas, and we're talking here before Dallas plays Baltimore. Dallas plays Baltimore. They win the next game, then they're a game out of first, right? Or a half game, or whatever it would be, depending on what Washington and the Giants do. So, and like, you would have never thought that the Giants have appeal, but now they do after the Seattle game. Or Washington. And when is a four-win team with a guy who was lucky to keep his leg – and then a couple of years later, they go into and beat the undefeated Steelers in Pittsburgh in December, right? So you don't know the way this is going to work out. I think because there's so many tight races in the NFC, it leaves the option much more on the table than it would, you know, in another scenario where the Cowboys' record was what it is. But, you know, Dallas has delivered. The NFC East has always delivered because of the markets. Like, I used to say during the Monday night days when we wouldn't get many NFC East games because Sunday night would get most of them, right?
Right.
But we'd get one, and I'd say, I must have said at least two or three times in an open, there's no rebuilding in the NFC East, right? And now it feels like they all are. And it feels like Philly is like scrambling to try to find a place to rebuild from. But Dallas, with a couple of wins away, gets themselves right back in, right? So let's see how they do against Baltimore, and then I'm sure Fred and all of our execs and those guys will have a plan to do it.
But I've had enough of watching the Cowboys. That's just my own personal – like, it's been enough. Andy Dalton, it's been enough. You mentioned Monday night. I got to ask you because, you know, people who are into media, who cover media like me, media, you know, there is this thing about people who leave ESPN and whether they go – you know, I think the narrative is a little false. I think more people leave ESPN and have success than people think. We see it now with Dan Le Batard. I think that's going to be a very interesting situation. But you're one of the people – you know, Dan Patrick, I think maybe was the first, but leaving ESPN, how much of a nerve-wracking decision is that to make? First, let's start.
Well, it's hard because it's 25 years of friends, and it doesn't just mean like, you know, the people you're on air with. It means the producers, the directors. You came through the ranks with a lot of the people who have become management and all that stuff. So it's that as a hurdle one, but then it's where you're going and what are you doing? And for me, it wasn't very hard when, you know, NBC said, you know, you'd be involved with our football, you know, whether it was Thursday night or the role, excuse me, that Bob had on the road doing Sunday night football, right, co-hosting Football Night in America, which I did for the first couple of years with Dan. I was on the road and he was in the studio, all of that stuff, plus the Olympics and the Triple Crown races. Those are things I never got to do. And it was just like, I turned 50, I did 25 years at ESPN, 10 years of Monday Night Football. It just felt like the right time and opportunity to write another chapter of a professional career. I'd only worked one other place at the TV station I started in Syracuse, New York. So for me, because of that.
Yeah, you had moved also a good gig.
Like a really good gig with exceptional people. I had known Fred Godelli, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football, and Drew Esikoff, the director, because I had known them from their time at ESPN and then their time at ABC when they were doing Monday Night and I was at ESPN. Obviously, we didn't cross paths as much, but we were all in the same corporate structure there. So there's that. There is Tommy Roy, the executive producer of our golf coverage, who I had known for a long time. When I worked the U.S. Open, when ESPN would carry the first 2 days of the U.S. Open, we'd work with Tommy and the NBC golf crew. So there were people there who I knew, who I trusted. Jimmy Roberts, who used to be there. Dan Hicks, who I had known, you know, over time. So all of a sudden you go, well, it really is a familiar place, much more than you think. And just I'd always from afar admired how NBC took on the tone of their coverage in everything. Everything felt like it was special. It didn't feel like NBC was doing 20,000 events, which I think ESPN deserves a ton of credit for. The tonnage and the quality of the tonnage is unique, but and it's difficult to do. But NBC just always felt like, I think it comes in part being the network of the Olympics. You know, there's something special about how you approach everything. And I've come to find in my 5 years there, that's the way people go after it. It's everything is treated with this is one of the most important things we're going to put on TV. Let's make it great. Yeah. And so that, I think all of that helped make the leap much easier than it otherwise would have been.
How bummed were you at the time when the NFL made that ridiculous decision that they wanted the A-team? My words, not Mike's. He's a good soldier. My words. If you can call Monday Night Football for ESPN, why can't you call Thursday Night Football for NBC? Yeah, that's what I never understood about that. But at that, I mean, obviously now it's all worked out. But at that time, how bummed were you?
Of course you're bummed because you enjoy doing primetime football games. And there is, like you said, in our business, very few things like it, but it also has made me appreciate it even more, you know, the opportunity to do it. And I will say this, it allowed me, Jimmy, to get some experiences and meet some folks that I otherwise might not have to really jump into the horse racing that we have. And I've enjoyed the Triple Crown so much. To mention the Notre Dame that we talked about before and get involved, get to know Brian Kelly, get to know a program. I mean, one of the advantages is we do Notre Dame 6-7 times a year. Nobody gets a chance to do that except maybe, you know, Joe and Troy may get the NFC hot team for 6 or 7. Nance and Tony probably get the Patriots when they were hot. You know, maybe they'll get Kansas City here the next year or two that many times, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, those were great opportunities that I otherwise wouldn't have had. And I got back into the studio, which is where I started, you know, way back when.
Yeah,
and I'm pretty comfortable in saying that I think that will help me when we get back to the Olympics. Mm-hmm. The amount of time I've spent in the studio here the last couple of years will help me when we're on the air for 17 nights from Tokyo, and probably help me in Pyeongchang, and hopefully will in Beijing as well. So overall, yeah, was it the ideal resolution of it? No, not personally, but at the end of the day, it's given me so many chances to do a bunch of other stuff. And that's pretty cool.
And you mentioned, you know, being on the beach and hanging out with Al. Do you guys, it's basically set up where you'll take over for Al. I mean, that's what the assumption is, that when Al ever decides not to do this anymore, which, you know, he's still as good as possible. So who knows when that's going to be. Do you guys ever joke about that? Do you guys ever discuss that? Is it ever a weird thing? Does Al ever say, "Well, you know, in a couple of years when you have my job"? Or
we don't joke about that per se, but we text, we'll email, we're in touch. We have a good laugh back and forth on stuff on a regular basis. We definitely have a really neat relationship, and I love the fact that he has been so welcoming to me from the start of coming over. And I'm going to even go before that, Jimmy. I'll go back to the ABC days. You know, when I followed Monday, when I got the Monday night job, I was the third guy to call the game, or fourth guy to call the games. Keith did a year, and then Frank, and then Al. You know, so really for me, it was like you're following Al Michaels as the voice of Monday Night Football. And quickly, everybody figured out that the Monday Night package was not what it was at ABC in the ESPN days. And that really became the Sunday Night package, right? That became that kind of premier package. But even then, Al was just great. We actually worked together at ABC on the Tiger Woods primetime golf shows. Out at Sherwood, out in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Al, it was me, Al, and Curtis Strange. We did a couple of those shows. So that's really where I got to meet Al for the first time. You know, it's Al Michaels. He's the all-time, you know, Mount Rushmore guy. And he has always been wonderful, terrific to me. And he's still, every time you watch Al, you learn something about, you know, how to do it and how to do it in a way that probably nobody else has done it before. So we get along great, and it's really cool.
At NBC, they've already signed Breeze, because the assumption is that it'll be you and Breeze doing Sunday night one of these years. But what do you make? And, you know, Fox has already signed Greg Olson, who's still playing. What do you make of this trend where networks are signing players who are still playing?
Well, we've actually signed Mahomes. That's his $500 million deal is done for going forward.
That'll bring ratings more than anybody in the booth. No offense.
it's an interesting trend, kind of looking forward to see what people want to do and what they're going to do going forward. You know, I hope both Drew and Greg have success and health and go forward. And then when they're ready, I think there are a bunch of guys who will be pretty good. I'll tell you a funny one I thought of just today. I was watching an NFL Films clip. Philip Rivers was mic'd.
Right.
And Philip Rivers is the all-time trash talker.
Yeah.
But he's got like a personality with it. Now, he has such a big family. I don't know if he would want to take on the commitment of doing football games, anything like that. But it just got me thinking about, you know, the four or five guys. Like, I think if Peyton ever did it, he'd be amazing. If Brady ever did it, he'd be incredible. Aaron Rodgers is as enjoyable a production meeting as anyone. Like, Aaron would be, all these guys are super smart. They like Romo see the game. I think I'll give you something different down this road, Jimmy.
Yeah.
I think you're going to enter a golden era of analysts for football in TV in the next 10 or 15 years. And I'll give you the why. I think when Peyton Manning redefined the quarterback position, so it's like, I'm going to get to the line with two plays. The vision of the quarterback controlling the game and understanding everything around him has expanded. Mm-hmm. And I think they see it live and call it out. So when they prepare for a broadcast in that mode, they're able to get in that Romo predicting play deal, which fans really, really enjoy, right? So I think we've got a whole generation of quarterbacks coming up who've been trained like that.
Yeah.
And I think like a perfect example of that is Dan Orlovsky, mm-hmm. who has done a terrific job. He started his career on Twitter, right?
Right.
And then he expanded. I remember reaching out to him like, man, your stuff's great. I learned watching you. He's doing it in games. And I think you're going to see a bunch of guys do that. And when you combine that with the personalities, the Super Bowl rings, and the guys who've been telegenic for years, I think we could enter in 10 years or so, a golden era of, if those guys want to do it, a golden era of analysts in a different way doing the game.
See, I feel like we're in that golden age now for play by play with, you know, you have Nance, Buck, Al, yourself. That's as good as it's going to get, I think, for play by play. For that, I think I wrote this recently. I think NFL fans are very lucky with the play by play that you get from NFL games. The Orlovsky thing I think is fascinating because it's a matter of whether a network will take a guy who's not the name recognition of a Romo or a Breeze. Yep. That's what's going to be interesting about it, to see if they take that chance, because, you know, networks want names. That's why ESPN goes after Manning every single year when Dan Orlovsky's sitting there and they're already paying him, you know. So,
but it's all subjective, right? But yeah. I always remind people, and I say this because he's one of my closest friends, you know, Kirk Herbstreit didn't come out of college football like a Heisman Trophy winner or a guy who won a national championship.
Right.
And he's the voice of college football. It has been now for a couple of decades. And he's the best studio analyst. He's the best game analyst. You know, he's the voice of the sport. And it just does show you that it doesn't have to be the superstar player. Right? Look at Joel Klatt, who does a great job of the games on Fox too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the same deal. So it is an interesting dynamic when networks have to hire guys. I would say, if I've watched anything during my time in the business, that the most important thing is the chemistry of the people who are going to work together.
Right.
And you don't have to be the best play-by-play guy and the best analyst to give you the best team. Like Al and Chris have done that for so long, right?
Yeah.
As long as you take two people who just have a really good vibe and connect with people, you know, that changes everybody who works with Ian Eagle is terrific.
Right. Right.
That has a lot to do with Ian.
Yeah.
Now, there's a little bit to do with me bragging.
You and Tony, I thought, were very, you know, I listen to you and Tony do Notre Dame, but I'm not locked into Notre Dame every single week. But, you know, doing the NFL, I thought you and Tony, it sounded like you and Tony were doing games for like 10 years, basically. There's definitely a chemistry there for sure.
Well, if you can't get along with Tony Dungy, you need to check out of the earth. I mean, he's the greatest person around. He's so nice, but he's so smart and he sees the game. And now sitting next to him doing football night for the last few years, you know, we truly sit now 6 feet apart, but next to each other and watch almost every NFL game during the regular season. And that comes with, you know, a group text with Rodney Harrison and Sims and Florio on stuff on a Monday or a Thursday or stuff or news during the week. And that naturally flows into, okay, it's Bears Packers. Well, it's maybe the 800th football game the two of us have watched in the same room in the last 3.5-4 years. Mm-hmm. So that just that's what I'm saying when, you know, if you find the right partnership, even if they're not the best in their individual group, and it includes a sideline reporter as well, like all of a sudden it becomes the most comfortable listen. At the end of the day, what do you want? You just want to be able to listen to somebody who's going to inform, give you the info, make you laugh every once in a while, stay out of the way of the game. I ain't watching the game for you. You know, right. I just tell people, you know, nobody's tuning in to watch me or to watch Al or to watch Jim. They're tuning in to watch the game, right? And if along the way we can enhance your experience doing that, then we've done what we should do.
Well, listen, you can't go by Twitter because everyone on there is just so overly critical. It's absurd. But like that, my thing is like, if I say a certain broadcaster is doing a good job and someone will say like, oh, he called this person the wrong name or he called... My issue, when I'm judging and I'm watching a game, I don't care if the play-by-play person makes a mistake. That's going to happen over a 3.5-hour game. I mean, listen, you don't want on the final play of the game to call the wrong team scoring a touchdown. Don't annoy me. That's all I'm asking for. That's the job. Right. Don't annoy me. Call the game, and that's it. So, but I think, but more than don't annoy me, I'm very sincere about it. I do think Al and Nance, Buck, yourself, are more than that. I think you guys are just all do a great job across the board. So when you're getting that lead NFL game, you know you're going to have a good broadcast. I think that's important.
Well, and I appreciate being included with them. They're all friends. They're all people I've always admired. And I'm honored to be mentioned in the same breath with them. I really do think that you have hit on something that's a very valid point, that this is as good a time as we've seen for television broadcasts in general, like the quality of the broadcast from a producing and directing standpoint too. And I think what your point was earlier about the number of eyeballs, look, everybody brings their best for an NFL game. You leave no stone unturned. You have everything in front of you, from Game Pass to Red Zone Channel during the, or the DirecTV Red Zone Channel during the Sundays. If you're not in front of that game, you're not getting that game. The amount of information, social media, there's no excuse. And you can get exposed, I think, quicker in this day and age.
Yes.
So it doesn't leave the place for a broadcaster to not come in supremely prepared. Now, part of my concern always, and I do see this with Notre Dame compared to the NFL, like in an NFL game, I know I've seen most of what's gone on during the year, but I may forget the play that Robert Spillane of the Steelers came up with his pick six. Like, I remember he had it. I remember it was in Tennessee. But I don't remember the exact circumstance per se. Was it first drive, second drive? But a Steeler fan knows that because they're living on every snap. Now, with Notre Dame, when I watch other people do Notre Dame, I know that I'm at an advantage because I've seen every snap the Irish have played the last 5 years.
Right.
When they play a road game, usually we'll get them the next week or 2 weeks later. That's a huge, huge, huge advantage because the fan at home. You're a Giants fan or Jets?
I don't have a team. I root for whoever I sort of have a wager on, basically.
that's nice.
I don't have a team. I like to watch the best games, and then I get attached to certain players each year.
So your neighbors who are Jets fans, Long Island, you know, they're living every snap. Right. So they know. And if you are doing a Jets game and the Jets will get passed off to like a half dozen different broadcast teams during the year.
Right.
Because of where they are, they may not have seen week three, week four. That puts you at a disadvantage. Yeah. That's where it becomes hard.
Yeah. Since I mentioned it, I was going to say I only really have two complaints about play by play people. And one, play by play people really don't give a shit about this complaint. I don't blame them. And the other one, you're just never going to agree. The first one is everyone should mention the point spreads when they're going to change. But I get why you don't. And you guys are too nice to the refs. The refs are so bad. And I don't mind if you don't kill the refs, but when I watch a game and I hear them like, oh, the refs do a great job. No, they don't. Just stop. But you can't address that. So we'll move on.
I don't want you
to address that.
When there's a play that happens and an official gets the call right live, should they get a shout out?
Sure.
Okay.
Because there are plays where here's where I give the refs credit. When you have the, as the great Nate Burleson says on Good Morning Football, the toe drag swag, when you have those where the feet are like tapping.
Yeah.
I give refs credit. I don't know how they see that.
Exactly.
But when I see them spot a ball 4 feet while where it's not supposed to be spot, or even the Tyreek Hill, the ref is standing right in front of him. He didn't see that. You know, I don't know. That one maybe is a little hard, but
here's the one thing refs will tell you is that we've got a better angle than they do. That's why I think the sky judge concept is great.
Right.
Because the 2 years that I did football night on the road, I'd go downstairs to, you know, either start the game, I'd stay downstairs for a couple, or if it was a big game, I'd watch a little bit of the first quarter from down on the field. I've got to tell you, you get blocked out a lot more than you think. Legs, it's like spotting the ball and spotting the ball in the mosh pit of fourth and one or the quarterback sneak. Where is it? On TV, sometimes you see it better. So
I guess where my bigger issue comes in is when they review the play, it takes 7 hours and then they still get it wrong. It's more that listen, you're going to miss a call. It's going to happen. That's going to happen. And like I said, they get it right with some things that you know, the catches sometimes with the sidelines, but when you review something, you take forever. It's rigged on. It shouldn't have been reviewed in the first place. Then you get it wrong. And then one thing
I've always wanted to do that I haven't had the time to do, and I hope I can, is to go to one of those like 3-day officiating clinics before the season starts.
Yeah.
Cause I really want to, I happen to think they do. I thought replay, especially in baseball, I thought replay showed that the umpires were a lot better than I thought they were. Cause on those bang, bang plays at second base. So those types of things, the catches you talk about, a lot of times I'll be watching like no catch. Oh, it's a catch. It is a catch. So,
but my issue is more around the replay, the whole, and then, if you have replay, you better not get it wrong. And it seems that they still get it wrong even with replay sometimes. I think that
it should be fast. It's like in the booth, okay, it's going to be 3rd and 4. Put it there. Reset the game clock. Let's go. And sometimes that takes way too long, especially in the ACC. The ACC replay nightmare. I felt like being in a washing machine every time the ACC and college football go to a replay this year. It's brutal.
Before I let you go, I should plug, Steve Kornacki is going to be on this podcast as well. You had fun with him on Sunday. That was great. Again, something different, something fun. That's what we need more of. I thought he did a really great job the way he broke that down. You look like you really enjoyed watching him do his thing.
So I'm a political nerd.
Right.
You know, like at night, I'll bounce around too. I'll watch MSNBC. I'll watch Fox. I'll watch CNN. I'll watch everybody. I was a political science major at Syracuse in addition to broadcast journalism. So I love politics. Kornacki, I watched him in the midterms. I'm like, this guy's in 2016. I'm like, this guy's amazing. He knows every county in America. It's nuts. He wrote a book. My son actually bought his book for me. It was about the political divide in America. It's called The Red and the Blue. And the book was outstanding. So I happened to email Steve this summer and say, hey, man, I loved your book. It was really, it really framed what we're in right now in American politics well for me. And so we had a little bit of an email back and forth connection before he came in the building last week. But thanks for saying it. It was great execution by our group. But like you said, it was fun. It was different. But it was the same information that we're usually throwing out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Playoff possibilities, you know? And he bought on. He's like, look, this Vegas Indianapolis game this coming Sunday is going to be huge. It's going to have the percentages change of probability for these guys. So it's like, great.
I'm sure we'll see him again on that pregame show.
Yes, you will.
The season
is
over. Yep.
He might be hosting the show. He may throw me to the sideline here.
I appreciate you coming on. I got to give a shout. Also, I don't know if you remember former NFL punter Drew Butler. He punted for the Steelers and Cardinals. He is the biggest Mike Tirico fan on the planet, just so you know.
We became
friendly over the years. He used to read my columns. We became friendly, and I literally text him every time you're doing a game, or he'll text me like, Tirico's doing this game. So He has a podcast, the Punt and Pass podcast, that covers college football at Aaron Murray. He's the biggest Mike Tirico fan on the planet. So I have to give him a shout out.
I remember him from those days as a dog. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. Well, thank you for that shout out. And I will now check out his podcast too. Because everybody's got one.
That's the problem. Yeah. Yep. Well, I appreciate you coming on mine, and good luck with Pittsburgh Buffalo. That should be a good one. And hopefully we'll see you down the road, do a couple more games, and enjoy the rest of the season and stay safe.
Yeah, you too. Most important thing. Thanks, Jimmy. Yep. I appreciate it. Thanks for all the good listening here over the way too. Enjoy your podcast.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Take care.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering two shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, joining me now, MSNBC political correspondent, also from NBC News, and one of the more popular figures of 2020, Steve Kornacki, is joining me here after his triumphant debut on Sunday Night Football as well. Hi, Steve. How's it going?
Jimmy, doing good. How about you?
Doing well. You know, it's funny. After the election, I had thought about trying to get you or John King on, and then you did the Sunday Night Football, and it was so great. And I'm like, I got to get this guy on, because at least now I have a sports angle, because I could have just talked to you about the election. So now at least I have an excuse, and I'm glad you came on. That was a lot of fun Sunday night, doing the pregame and halftime that show there for NBC.
Thanks. I appreciate you saying that, because it was incredibly exciting for me to get the chance. I do politics, I do elections. But I mean, I'm a football fan my whole life, been watching Sunday Night Football since it started about 15 years ago. So to get that chance was really, it was a thrill for me. So
I assume this was just an extension of, like, you know, election night, you really became this pop culture phenomenon, and in the days after, since it dragged out, and I guess NBC figured, like, let's capitalize on this. I assume it was their NBC Sports idea. How did it come about where we got you on the show?
Yeah, no, I got a call. My boss here, probably a week after the election, you know, just saying, hey, you know, NBC Sports reached out. They, you know, have some ideas, would love to talk to you. Are you interested? I said, you know, are you kidding? Of course. And we just kind of, you know, put it together, and there you go. That's what we had Sunday night.
And I'm sure we'll be seeing you again on there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think the plan is, you know, it's I did the road to 270, you know, for most of 2020, and now the road to the playoffs. So we'll cover that story, you know.
Will you be on this week, do you know, this Sunday?
That's the plan, yeah.
Okay. Because we're coming down to the nitty gritty here, so it'd be great if they got you on there every week, if I don't know if that's possible, but.
It's a good time to pick up if I'm going to do road to the playoffs to start in December. I mean, that's when it gets real. So, yeah.
How much, in terms of time, hours, minutes, whatever it was, how much prep work did you have to do for your Sunday night hits on Football Night in America?
I think a fair amount. Really familiarizing myself with the probability models, because that's the piece of it that I think we were trying to add. You know, you've got the standings 1-7, you know, in each conference now. The remaining schedules. I mean, I think people are used to seeing that, used to going over it that way, but it was the idea of, well, okay, you know, Baltimore sitting there in ninth place right now in the AFC, but they've got basically the same shot of being in the playoffs, you know, as Miami, who's in the sixth, you know, seed right now. Mm-hmm. You know, why is that? Why does the probability model like Baltimore so much? Why does it not like Miami? If you look at the NFC, it really likes Arizona. It really doesn't like Minnesota, even though the Vikings would right now be in the playoffs if they started today. So I think it's finding out the logic behind those numbers. And I think a lot of Sunday for me was, you know, as the games kind of, you know, played themselves out, plugging in the different scenarios at any given minute and just seeing how the numbers move to get a sense of, like, you know, for instance, you know, when the Raiders got that last second touchdown against the Jets, I mean, their playoff chances like tripled basically with that. They went from, you know, somewhere in the teens to somewhere close to 50%. To be able to identify a swing like that, that was the kind of thing we talked about adding, you know, that's not out there as much right now.
But were you in the studio all day Sunday watching the games with the Mike Tirico's on this podcast as well? We already taped with him, and we talked about your appearance. Because I told Mike he looked very, very excited about what you were doing with the maps, and came out well. So Mike had high praise for you, which Mike, we listeners heard Mike before you on this podcast, but were you in the studio all day Sunday with those guys and watching the games?
Yeah. They have a, you know, a viewing room there. You know, so just, you know, got up there about 1 o'clock, you know, watched the games. For me, it was just, again, somebody who's just been watching this as a viewer, you know, for years, to watch the show come together. You know, there was a lot of, so that's where that comes from. That's where this, you know, it was very interesting to get that behind the scenes look. And yeah, they were all, you know, just great to me. Mike Tirico was just super, super welcoming, super generous. And is, you know, you really could see from my standpoint what a pro he is.
Yeah.
Just how smooth on the air, you know?
Yeah. I don't want to imply that you didn't work hard on Sunday, but I would assume that was just a complete walk in the park compared to what you had to do in that first week of November.
They're very, very different things. I think the stress, there was stress for me on Sunday. And it was a different kind of stress, though.
Yeah.
It was the stress of, I'm about to do something in front of an audience that, you know, I think a lot of those has never heard of me. Or if they have heard of me, they associate me only with politics. So I don't have any built-in credibility with this audience when it comes to football. And I've got to show this audience that this is not a gimmick, that there's something, you know, useful that I can offer here. So it was a different kind of stress, but it was more stressful than sitting at a bar watching all the games there.
Yeah. How, were you taken aback at all by just how, sort of how much attention you got, and even, and John King on CNN, I felt like, you know, Twitter is a place where everybody hates everything. And the two of you were so universally praised. And I was thinking about it, and I was familiar with both your work from past elections, but it seemed like so many new people, and we know from the votes, the legal votes, not the rigged ones, more people voted, you know, this year than in, you know, there's so many votes for both Biden and Trump. So I don't know if it was just more eyeballs were on you guys. I think people have just gotten into politics because of the insanity of the last 4 years. But I was taken aback by it. Felt like so many people were just discovering you and even John King on CNN.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard from my, you know, vantage point to really see kind of what was happening, you know, until a couple of days in. I just so locked in. But yeah, no, I mean, that's all stuff I feel like I've been kind of picking up on the last 4 years. Just, you know, people in my life who were never really interested in. I was always the oddity at, like, you know, parties and going back to college or whatever, you know, being interested in politics, being interested in elections.
Yeah.
And now it's just everybody seems to be into it, whatever side they're on. Everybody seems to have a real interest in it. And so, yeah, I mean, you saw it in the turnout. You see it in the passion. You see it in just your everyday interactions with people. And then I think, yeah, just the fact that this one, you know, I was looking back at the 2016 election. Obviously, that was a very, very close election, and, you know, it came down to a few votes in a few states. But that was called at basically 1:30 a.m. on election night. You know, this one called at 11:30 a.m. on Saturday. So that drawn out aspect to it, too, besides the 36-day recount in Florida in 2000. We haven't had a presidential race that's taken this long to settle.
Yeah, there are a lot of people in this country who spent more time with you over 3 or 4 days than their families, basically, that first week of November.
I like to tell myself maybe the families were all watching together. But
yeah. Tell me, so when election night comes, November 3rd, when do you start prepping for that? I mean, is it when Biden gets the Democratic nomination? Is it before then? When do you even start the prep for that night?
Yeah, no, for me, just from a, you know, kind of career standpoint, the thing about the pandemic was it actually gave me much more time, you know, much more time to sit in the office or sit at a desk and just go through, you know, counties and go through past election data and, you know, just all the stuff that, you know, normally I'd be juggling a lot more in an election year. So I actually had a lot more time, I think, to be prepping for it this year. And I think also it's just I've been doing elections, you know, election night since 2014 now. And I think when I compare the sort of accumulated knowledge that I brought into 2020 for how to do an election night, you know, versus where I started the first night I did it in 2014, I feel like I'm kind of light years ahead of where I was back then. And that's just from, you know, from going through this routine of preparing every 2 years, you know, special elections in between. You know, I think there's a lot of sort of accumulated, you know, kind of info that I've built up. So there were variables, though, this time. The stress for me this time was really just the degree of mail-in voting. We've never had anything like it before. And we knew going in that there were just going to be these enormous differences between the mail vote was going to be overwhelmingly Biden. The people that turned out on election day and voted were going to be pretty solidly Trump. And just at any given moment, I needed to know if I'm looking at results in any state, am I looking at the mail votes? Am I looking at the same day votes? Am I looking at a mix of both? What is that mix? And that's something I've just never really had to worry about before. So that was new this time. And to a certain degree, there was only so much prep you could do for that because you had to just see how it went.
But what about also just knowing every single county in America? How do you learn those? How long does that take? I mean, it's remarkable what you do on the map. Just, I mean, you know, you go from state to state, county to county. Is it just like, you know, when, you know, everyone was a kid in school and you learned the capitals of the United States? Is it just like that? And it's just memorization? How much do you have to study that day before you're on the air? How do you get those counties down like that?
Yeah, no, if I was doing it that day, it'd be hopeless. I think it is a lot of studying. It's a lot of memorization. I've always kind of had an interest in geography. You know, I maps as a kid, I always kind of had an interest in. So I think there's, I'm sort of just kind of oriented that way anyway. You know, doing this, as I said, since 2014 for election nights, that's helped because you retain from election to election. I found you retain a lot of what you kind of, what you learn. It helps too that, look, I know going into this election, the dozen states or so that are really going to be kind of the epicenter of it. So if I,
you can lock in and focus on those.
Yeah. I wasn't as focused on the counties in Mississippi, for instance.
Right. Right.
Because I knew that wasn't really going to be the story.
Right.
So that helps too, but yeah, it is, it's just a lot of, a lot of it is just old fashioned memorization and repetition. Stuff you might do in college, cramming for a final or something.
If you could only pick one, if I asked you, what is the single most difficult thing about working on election night, November 3rd, those hours, one thing, the hardest, what is it?
It really, to me, this year was, in some states this was clear, but there were a few states where it was very unclear. The mail-in votes versus the same day votes.
Right.
Some states, Florida comes right to mind, North Carolina, Texas. They report out the results in a very orderly way. And other states, Ohio, for instance, there was some confusion there. And, that was just something, I think if we keep doing voting like this going forward, I'll kind of learn the nuances of it. But, there were some very, very stressful moments there, I'm thinking, especially around Ohio, around 11 o'clock election night.
Were you surprised? Now, if anyone paid attention to the news and understood facts, unlike Trump, everyone sort of knew going in, we were all told very, very little chance, probably no chance we'd get results that night. We all knew it might. Were you surprised though it dragged out till Saturday at 11:30 in the morning, or did you expect that?
Yeah, I mean, that was honestly the range of possibilities in my mind going into this election for how short or long it would take was wider than I've ever seen. And it was on the short end, it was basically this. We knew Florida was going to get all of its votes reported out election night, probably by 11 o'clock. And if Biden won Florida, the decision desk would not have called it on the spot, but we would have known. I mean, Florida would have just upended the electoral map in a way that you knew the outcome. So on the short end, I thought there's a possibility Biden wins Florida. And by 11 o'clock, conversation has shifted from the map to like, okay, Biden's probably going to win this election. And it kind of moves away from what I do. So that was the short end in my mind. Long end was, 2000. I think back to Florida in 2000, where, you had one state that was going to, swing the electoral college either way. And that one state was a matter of a couple hundred contested, ballots, essentially. Yeah. And in a situation like that, you're talking weeks. So, Saturday at 11:30 a.m. honestly was somewhere right in the middle of the range that I had in my mind.
It's funny because we all obviously get caught up in what's going on at the moment. But to piggyback off what you said, with this election dragging out, I went back a couple of days after the election, maybe a week after. And there's a video on YouTube of Dan Rather from the election night in 2000. And when you watch it, you're like, this is just as crazy as what's going on now. But you think there's nothing crazier than what's going on now because we've had a deranged person running the country for 4 years. But if you go and watch that YouTube video, then at one point it's like, well, it's 11:30 in Florida, this, and it's 1:30 in the morning. And then it's like, it's 4 a.m. and we still don't know. So, like we talked about earlier, a lot of people are so new to politics and what's going on here, but go watch that video of Dan Rather on YouTube from 2000, and not a ton has changed from election night standpoint.
I remember the 2000 election. That was my senior year of college, and I remember having a paper due the next morning. And my plan that night had been, I'll watch the election results, and about 11 o'clock, I'll start on the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was Florida was called early for Gore, and you thought, okay, Gore's going to be the president. Then they took it back. Then they called it for Bush. Then they took it back, and it was. This one was crazy. And I mean, look, you can look at the electoral map and you could say a swing of basically 44,000 votes across three states, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, right now would switch this to a Trump victory.
Right.
But in Florida in 2000, you were talking about 537 votes in one state. And you were talking about, like, I remember late that night, somebody came on the air and said, by the way, have you seen this ballot in Palm Beach County, Florida? And this is where you had probably a couple thousand people who thought they were voting for Al Gore actually punching the hole for Pat Buchanan. I mean, that could have been the difference, you know. And right, then the people said, well, they called the state early for Gore and the panhandle people didn't show up and vote. That could have swung. I mean, when it's that tight, anything could make
it. Yeah. I also went and watched a documentary on HBO after this madness about the 2000 election. I forgot the name of it now. I think maybe it's called The Count, maybe. I could be wrong about that. But it goes into about sort of how Elian Gonzalez affected the 2000 election. I don't know if you saw that on HBO, but that was a it makes you feel better about how insane things are now because we survived all that. Hopefully we survive all this and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that was the closest thing we've had to a tie and maybe we'll ever have to a real tie in a presidential election.
Do you think, I mean, a lot of what Donald Trump is doing now and his team, it's all nonsense and, you know, you could get into whether he's just scamming people out of money. There always, but like, do you think anything in our elections will change based on what happened this year? Do you think it's just going to stay the way it is? I mean, obviously mail-in was huge this year because of COVID. Do you see a lot of change in how we vote? Or do you think, part of me thinks like we're such a mess. We wouldn't be able even to enact the change. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, part of it is just that we are, and I think one thing this election has shown in the post-election period has reminded us is how decentralized this all is. You know, each state has its own procedures.
Right,
each county, each municipality within a county will have its own procedures, and that can make it, you know, kind of cumbersome just in terms of trying to get a sense of what's going on. But that also, there are probably, you know, positive aspects of that too, just, but I do think so. I don't envision a scenario where top down from the federal government down, there's sort of giant reforms that come out of this. But I think there are conversations that individual states probably need to be having here about, this expansion of mail-in voting. Is that a thing we're gonna make permanent now? And if so, are we going to change the procedures so that when the ballots come in ahead of election day, we can process them and it doesn't take a week after the election?
Right.
Is that a change we're going to put into our law? Because that was the biggest reason for the delay in, you know, in Pennsylvania, if you are going to have, you know, really widespread, you know, mail-in voting the way we saw this year, I think there are folks who make an argument, okay, but the calendar on that needs to be tighter, like maybe 2 weeks before the election, maybe 3 weeks. Don't have presidential debates taking place,
right,
you know, 3 weeks after the voting's begun. I think conversations like that, you know, if you're going to say, hey, you know, let's try to get everybody voting more at the same time here, is there a conversation to be had there about not election day, but election weekend? Mm-hmm. I think there are all sorts of different directions, you know, you could take the conversation, but I feel like we've kind of got a real mishmash of procedures here that were kind of understandably cobbled together because of the pandemic. But
it does seem like
a lot to be discussed.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's huge issues, which you've gone into. And then there's just what to me seem like very basic, simple common sense issues like, can we vote on a Saturday or Sunday when most people are not working? And so, you know, how's that not just an easy fix? But I guess, you know, for government to change that takes a lot.
I wonder if there's a compromise there, though, too, because you hear, you know, the argument seems to be from the left. The idea is, you know, expand the mail-in voting, expand, you know, and from the right, it tends to be more. I mean, you heard it from Trump, make it election day. Is there some kind of a compromise there where election day becomes a wider period? Yeah. But you can concentrate. So I wonder about it. Although I have to say, I also wonder if the logic of that is going to change, just the partisan argument around that, because there'd been an assumption among Democrats that the more you expand the electorate through things like mail-in voting, the more it's going to help Democrats. And I think you could make an argument that in a lot of these states, the expanded electorate might actually have brought in, you know, voters who wouldn't normally vote and voted for Trump and maybe made this thing closer than the polls were indicating, you know. So there's incentive there for Republicans that they didn't see before.
Yeah. Let's get into some fun things here before we wrap up. Because like I said, you've become this internet sensation. Do you have a preference on Chart Throb or Map God?
I'll take whatever option is.
And what do you have any relationship with John King? Do you guys hate each other and wish bad things upon each other? Are you like text friends? Because it's sort of like you two are, you know, the ones who do this.
Yeah, I don't know him. I have no, and I've seen him asked about me. I see people ask about this, and I've seen him say something that's true from my end too. And that's just, you know, when you get to it on election night, I'm so locked into what we're doing on the air and the numbers coming in. And I never see CNN. I never see Fox. I never see what anybody else is doing. Right. And I know he said that about us too. And it's, I have, he's been doing this longer than I have, you know, and I think when you look at the evolution of election nights on television over the last couple of decades, the idea of having a board with an interactive map and real-time data, that's something that started, you know, with him and with CNN. And so I, you know, I have no interest in getting into any kind of a fight with them. I have no, I really don't. I truly do have respect for him. So
Massachusetts
guy too. So, you know,
I thought maybe you guys would even have a relationship based on like the fact that you are the only two who are really doing it in such an epic way. So,
yeah, no, I've actually, and he's based in DC. I'm based in New York. So I think we've been in the same room at functions or something, but I haven't actually met him. No.
Do you own a pair of jeans?
I think I used to. Don't now.
I thought it was great. I mean, you know, like we're having fun. You know, obviously what you cover is so serious, and the fact that it's become so many lighthearted things have come out of it. I saw that, I guess you got teamed up with The Gap and donated a bunch of 500 pairs of khakis to Boys and Girls Club. I thought that was a nice way to use all of this nonsense to, you know, do something good.
It's it's funny. Like I, for years here, you know, I've probably dressed down too much on the air, and occasionally the higher ups will take.
But see, that appeals to people.
That's the funny thing that came out of this, you know, election, because it's because of the pandemic. 30 Rock is empty, and it's been there's like no adult supervision here all of a sudden. So I could get away with just wearing my normal, my, you know, khakis are what I would wear every day. I just start wearing it on the air and there's nobody here to tell me no.
Right.
And so I happen to be doing an election. Well,
if the casual viewer is flipping the channels and they see a guy in a suit, they're just going to think you're like everyone else. But if they see with the sleeves rolled up and the khakis, they're like, oh, what's going on here? This guy maybe is bringing something different to the table.
I think that's, for me, that's one of the best things, you know, to come out of this for the foreseeable future. They're not going to try to force me into a suit anymore.
Yeah. How many pairs of khakis are in the collection? Do you know?
I think it's 5.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah,
the Gap needs to hook you up. What are they doing?
Well, they offered me, like, you know, pants for life. And I said, really, I got 5. That'll last me for 10 years. And so give them the charity. Give them to the kids, you know.
Here might be the most important question I ask you during this entire interview. How are you not verified on Twitter?
I don't want to be.
No,
I want to be people. It's, you know what? It's like I didn't give it much thought. And I started getting the question from so many people, and I would find myself asking, why does it matter? I get there's this argument about like impersonators or something.
Yeah.
I just said, look, if that ever really became an issue, fine, I'll do it then. But otherwise, it just seems like it seems like a weird status symbol to me.
But most people do what you do. It would be like the NBC PR department would get you verified. You wouldn't do it on your own. So that's why it's a little, and given that, you know, you're like the face of the network on election night, you'd think you'd have the blue check mark. So I was just,
they've asked, and I it's one of these where I think I'm just being stubborn, but I just sort of gotten by along without it. So,
Last thing here, you wrote a book, in 2018, The Red and the Blue, the 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. You did a little run, as we said, on Sunday on the NFL pregame show. You're going to do it again. More tribal politics or sports?
It used to be easy. It used to be sports.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so much very similar now. And I think there's that thing you see in sports where it's like, if there's a contested call in a game, right, and it goes against the home team, the fans are always going to say it's the worst call ever, no matter what. Even if you if you zoom in on the replay and, oh, no, he actually was out of bounds, they're always going to tell you it was a terrible call. And, you know, the other team is always going to say, you know, it was a great call. I see that sort of, I think that's entered politics in a lot of ways where, you know, people fix to the tribal or the partisan loyalty, and then they work backwards from there.
Right.
And I, you know, there's always been a degree of that in politics, but I think it's deeper now.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said
are more than ever, you know?
Yeah. I've always said, I mean, I'm a sports fan. I cover sports for a living. I work for Sports Illustrated, but I've always said, you know, sports fans are not sane. We all have something wrong with us. So the fact that politics has now become that is really not good for the United States of America.
I think I agree with you there. Yeah.
I know you cover more of the elections, the numbers, the percentages, the maps, but you know, since I have you on, I have to ask, because of what we've gone through the past 4 years, do you and I want to piggyback on the tribalism in the book you wrote. I mean, can we fix this? Can we ever get it back to somewhat some normalcy? Or, you know, 73 million people, you know, voted for Trump. Is the horse out of the barn and there's no turning back now on getting this country to be somewhat stable and normal and sane?
You know, it's every event I did for the book, you know, that version of that question would be asked of basically, you know, you're writing about the rise of tribalism. What's the solution? And I racked my brain trying to come up with a smart answer to that. And I couldn't, because the thing that kept hitting me was that I think, you know, as human beings, we're wired in some very core way to think tribally, you know, and it comes out very easily in like sports you're talking about. And as we say, it's coming out in politics now. And I think a lot of it has to do with the evolution of media over the last, I'd say, half century, the nationalization of media, and now kind of the personalization of it through social media, through iPhones, through Twitter. And I think it really just creates and enforces and hardens these tribal divisions and reinforces them. It's just constantly, perpetually reinforcing them. And I think it's just the media, the evolution of media has kind of synced up with something that's deep within us. And I agree. I don't think it's good at all. The only thing I can come up with is, if we got ourselves into this, maybe we all collectively get sick of it enough. You know, humans are endlessly creative. Maybe we can find a way out of it. I just don't know what that way is.
Yeah, it's a very complicated issue, but I think just if you want to even just simplify it, I'm just hoping from a personal standpoint is that not having to worry about the most important person in this country tweeting all day long should help us a little bit over the next 4 years, you would think, just from that standpoint. So maybe there's a way to make it a little better. But we'll see. Like you said, you know, the role of social media, the internet, it's scary what it's done to the country in a lot of ways.
I think it's proven itself really good at tearing things down.
Yeah.
What's it built up, you know?
Yeah. Before I let you have a Super Bowl prediction before I let you go, now that you're covering the NFL, what do we got?
Who's got the best chances? I can't speak for our statistical models or anything, but yeah. the Steve K, you know, gut check. I mean, Chiefs to me look like, I mean, until somebody can show, Pittsburgh had my attention, but now I'd say Kansas City in my gut.
The AFC is the easy one. It's the NFC where we got to see who comes out of that.
I feel like, again, just my gut, I feel like Green Bay is kind of turning it on at the right time here.
Mm-hmm.
Probably what I'd say right now. But yeah, hey, who knows? Maybe Tom Brady and Tampa will get it going down the stretch.
KC Green Bay would be a great one for television drama and everything else. KC Tampa Bay would, Brady back there with the Bucks would be good for content, as we say in the business.
And I'm a Pats fan, but I'm one of those who went with, I'm Team Brady too. So
it's going to be interesting to see what he does in the playoffs, because they got things they're figuring out. So appreciate you coming on, and we look forward to seeing you now on Sunday nights there on Football Night in America, however many more weeks you do it there with Mike Tirico and Tony Dungy and that crew. So good luck in the sports world. And now, what do you do now? What's the election angle or the political angle? What do you do here? You don't have an election to cover, you don't have maps. What does Steve Kornacki do for MSNBC now?
Well, it's funny. I'm not done yet, because we've got Georgia on.
Right.
So that's my, you know, I'm juggling that right now. We're studying up on, you know, counties in Georgia, demographics, you know, where did Trump do worse than the Republican Senate candidates, and trying to game that one out. So
do we have an idea of how that's looking, or is it too early?
It's, you know, it's like I can make the argument that the Republicans are better positioned there, just because those Republican Senate candidates did a little bit better than Trump in Georgia. Okay.
Right.
You know, Trump lost the state, but they got more votes than Democrats. But you could also make the argument that, you know, the way Trump has handled the post-election here, you look at Georgia in that presidential election, there are voters in the Atlanta metro area who pretty clearly showed up on election day and said, I don't want Trump and I don't want Democrats in the Senate. And they voted, you know, Biden, and they voted Republican in the Senate. And I think the risk for Republicans, those same voters look at this election, they look at Trump's behavior, and they say, I want to vote against Trump again. And the only way for them to do that now would be to vote for the Democrat. That's the best chance Democrats have, because they need to make a little extra ground at the center in that state.
That'll be fun, and I'm sure everyone will be watching and checking out your khakis and giving you nicknames and watching you work that map. Have you ever had the map go out on you?
Oh, yeah, very much. We did one.
Do you start screaming like code red, what do you do when the map goes out?
I had one. This was election night 2016 at some point, and you know, we got the Electoral College calculator, and this was, it was getting real election night 2016. Well, Trump's got a chance. What would it take? And they came to me, they were like, we want to go through the scenario right now. It's like, punch all the states, if this holds, if this holds, if this holds. And then I look over at the running tally and there's been some kind of malfunction. And suddenly it adds up to like 900 electoral votes. I think they caught me on film. I said, this piece of garbage. And I walked away from it.
That's the stuff people like me love. We love when we get a clip out of that and put it on Twitter. And we there's some people out there like me. We root for the glitches. We want the map to go out. We want the anarchy. I'm sure for you, that's just not what you need at all during those.
I'm glad that didn't happen this time around. Yeah.
All right, Steve, I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on, and continued success and stay all safe. Right.
Thank you, Jimmy. You too. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care. All right. My thanks to Mike Tirico and Steve Kornacki. Really enjoyed speaking to both of them. Great conversations with both. Appreciate them coming on. If you're not a subscriber, this is your first time listening to the SI Media Podcast, please hit the subscribe button. I said podcast. Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. And listen to some previous episodes. We've had a great run of guests. Chris Long, Andrew Marchand, The Undertaker, Jim Nance, all on in recent weeks. So check those out if you missed any of those. And like I said, please subscribe. All right, that wraps it up. Chris Mad Dog Russo from SiriusXM, MLB Network, the old Mike Meadow days. He's on the pod next week, so be on the lookout for that, especially you New Yorkers out there, with Mad Dog on the SI Media Podcast next week. And that's it. We'll see you then. Take care. Stay safe.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering 2 shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.